The Guardian.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly Lockdown. We don't know what episode lockdown it is anymore. Barry is in his house, got his first cigarette of the day, puffing away, and there he is. And you shaved today, Barry.
I did. I shaved today, and then I was putting on aftershave, and it was stinging my cheeks, and I suddenly realised, what am I doing this for? There's really no need.
Do you know what? I had my first thought yesterday, you know, on hair growth, and thinking, this is the first time in my life I could, if I carried on going, go full Tony Polster, full Ian Marshall, and perhaps the last season I play football, I could have a proper 80s mullet.
Well, if it gives you the same superpowers as Tony Polster and Ian Marshall had, I would highly recommend going for it. Why not?
And why not? It could slow me down a tiny bit, and there's not a lot of pace there.
Well, rather than talk about your footballing prowess or lack thereof, Max, you've had quite the week, haven't you? You've had basically a hit single.
I've had a hit single.
Yeah, because at a recent live show, you debuted a song you'd written called In Your Back Garden. I hadn't heard it before it was played live. And I have to say, and it kills me to say this, is one of the funniest things I've ever heard. And I was in tears laughing. So you put it on Twitter recently, and you got loads and loads of praise. And you were talking about it before we started recording this, and in the background I could hear your wife in a state of extreme exasperation going, "Oh, mate, you're not still banging on about that tune, are you? I'm going to delete it." So you've clearly got a big head over the success of your single. You're already planning the follow-up.
Yes, I am. Yeah.
Which I have heard. A tribute to a certain Southampton midfielder. It's been quite the roller coaster ride for you this week. And then yesterday, your printer broke down and you had to try to fix it. It's just high octane excitement all the way.
Well, as you pointed out, even though I may have gone viral on Tuesday, you still have more views for just pouring a can of beer. So, you know. And also, Steve has been in touch, Barry, to say Barry was referenced on Have I Got News For You this week. Is he becoming too big for the pod?
Yeah, I was. That was quite the shock. A friend of mine told me that I'd been referenced on or name checked on Have I Got News For You. And I asked him why. And he said, "Oh, I don't know." And that left me really, really worried. But I was name checked because of an article I'd written about the PDC darts at home. And Gary Anderson was the odd one out of four people. Because he was the only one who wasn't able to work from home because his Wi-Fi wasn't good enough.
Now, look, we got a lovely email. It says, "Dear Max and Barry, please consider yourself essential personnel during this pandemic, at least to this nurse working on the East Coast of the United States. As a relatively new listener to your podcast, I've become strangely addicted to what you write on the sides of elephants, how you pronounce Club Brugge, and which of your contributors is actually a doctor. And there's the bits about soccer too, which I actually also listen to. Thank you. So please carry on. Your voices literally cheerfully ring through the darkness of semi-rural Connecticut during my long drives into my night shift and balance out my invisible worm thoughts of how many COVID patients my hospital now has or how many of my co-workers have either tested positive or are now under quarantine. Thanks again for a great podcast." It's very kind of you. Thank you. And that's from David Fau, P-F-A-U. Then he says, he's an American. He says, "May I make a suggestion to your American listeners who, similar to me, still have jobs but still received a one-time Trump bucks economic stimulus payment that many of us did not need during this crisis? Use some of that money to subscribe to The Guardian. I did. Rather than mooching content for free, I feel better now that I'm contributing a little to cutting-edge world-class journalism, editorial independence, and insightful commentary. And then there's Football Weekly. May I suggest," he says, "Barry's dulcet tones on the voicemail answering machine. So could you, for David Pfau," and I don't know how to pronounce his surname, which is an issue when you're recording a voicemail, "record a voicemail note for David Pfau."
"Hi, you're through to David, the nurse from Connecticut. I can't take your call right now because I'm busy saving lives, but Leave a message and I'll get back to you as soon as I can.
And if anyone else wants to support The Guardian, there is now a special link to tell the boffins that it has definitely come from this podcast, which is gu.com/footballweeklypod. gu.com/footballweeklypod. Obviously, we understand a lot of you don't have a lot of money right now, so please do not feel obliged. But if you've just got countless millions lying around, give them to us. And if you go through that link, all the money goes into Barry's pockets.
I'm basically like, you know that gif of Scrooge McDuck in a bathtub full of gold coins? I was actually talking to my mum yesterday, and she told me that she had made a donation to The Guardian, as well as donating her son, obviously, her favourite and only son. But she'd made quite a worryingly substantial donation. I think she's trying to keep me in a job just to make sure I don't end up, you know, on the doorstep in Burr with a suitcase in each hand.
Right. Part two will begin in just a second. Plenty's been going on in football, so we're getting Sid Lowe on and Philippe Auclair, and we'll talk you through all of it.
The Guardian Science Weekly podcast is exploring some of the crucial scientific questions surrounding COVID-19. From soap,
it does not matter how good your soap is, it is how you apply it on your hands,
to social distancing.
The fact that we're doing this online means I'm unlikely to spread an infectious disease to you.
To unlocking a lockdown.
If you ease off when your infections are still at a very high level, you're just going to maintain infections.
Listen to Science Weekly from The Guardian on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to part two of The Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Joining us are Philippe Auclair and Sid Lowe. Sid, how are you?
I'm all right, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, good, thanks. What's the latest state of play in lockdown in Spain, and how unlocked you're becoming?
Well, the announcement this week involved a what they described as a de-escalation of the lockdown, and that's got a series of phases which, from a footballing point of view, from a sports point of view, are significant, which involves, for example, the reopening of elite centres for professional sportsmen, the beginning of individual training sessions, and then for normal people, the rest of us, for example, from this Saturday, there will be the possibility to go out and do exercise 1 hour a day. Now, in terms of how this kind of affects La Liga, it effectively means that the protocol that we've talked about before that they put together probably can get started as of next week, and we think that the football teams will be in training sessions by the second week of May.
Are you still doing your 100 keepy-ups?
Yeah, I'm trying to. Yeah, I mean, I haven't for a few days. I've been very busy, but I'm trying to. The thing here as well, by the way, with when they announced that kids could go out, they did say, and kids can take toys with them. So obviously we took that to mean, you know, a scooter or a football in particular. And we funnily enough, found a gap in a fence by a car park near our house, which opened into this kind of field that no one was in. So it worked out very nicely for us. And an hour of which, you know, kind of walk around for half an hour and then get the ball out.
Philippe, bonjour, ça va?
Ça va bien, Max, et toi?
Muy bien. Now, a lot of people found out on the Philippe Auclair, This Is Your Life pod, that you are a very successful musician and you've been putting that to good use.
Yeah, I've tried to. I finally got absolutely sick and tired of receiving royalty statements where every single stream on Spotify was a millionth of a centavo. So I decided to put all of my music on this website called Bandcamp, which allows musicians to put their stuff directly for streaming and of course for sale. And by the way, Max, do you know that this Friday, Bandcamp has an initiative by which they do not take any money away from the artist, so 100% of sales goes to the artist, that is, this Friday. That's exciting. So
I might start writing some songs. All right, let's crack on then. France team sports have been banned until September, so Ligue 1 has become the biggest league to have cut their 2019-20 season short. How's that being received?
To be honest, you would have thought, okay, that solves the problem. It's in a way because we have got a situation. We know where we are at, and in fact, it's the opposite. We don't know. And the explanation of that is simple, is that when Edouard Philippe, the Prime Minister, talked to the National Assembly, football was only mentioned in one sentence, and very briefly, when he said that the 2019-20 season in professional sport, which includes football, was over. That's basically what he said, more or less. And that was it. It was within a speech which was much, much longer and actually in many ways was much more important. It dealt with far more important things. So people thought, okay, so it means the season has stopped. But unfortunately, it is not quite apparently what is going on, because there is still a possibility, some wriggle room, that the season, should people want to, perhaps resume in August under closed door, behind closed doors. It's a possibility. I'm not saying this is what's going to happen. At the moment, it looks as if sport will stop until 1st of September, as well as all events in which more than 5,000 people get together, which unbelievably also includes the games of AS Monaco, which is a bit of a surprise. And therefore, you've got the situation where you've got the French Federation and the French League haven't got the same position. The French FA is in favor of stopping the season now and to decide that the table we have at the moment is the table that's going to be used for relegation, for the award of title to PSG, for qualification for European competitions. Now, you can imagine how well this is going down with the teams which are in the relegation zone but still have a hope to escape it, like Amiens, for example. So they're furious. Similarly, Lille, who are just behind Rennes in a qualification spot for the Champions League, are absolutely furious because they say we have got, in sporting terms, we have got a chance to qualify for the Champions League. It's going to be denied to us by the French FA. And you think as well, the French FA is not in charge of the league, but the league itself hasn't come to a decision yet. So, and it's even more complicated than that. So it's basically, Max, I'll sum it up in one word, in three words, it's a mess. The only thing we know is that there will be no sport, mass sport, until the 1st of September. The rest is still very much up in the air, with also PSG explaining that they might have to play their Champions League games, because they're in the quarters, abroad, which also opens a whole new can of worms, because where abroad? China? I mean, there were even, can you believe it, Max, there was a rumor circulating about 3 weeks ago that PSG had entered negotiations with UEFA to have Qatar as a possible site for a final eight. Can you actually believe this? I can.
You mentioned the Champions League, and you've got PSG and Lyon, right? And Lyon still got to go to play Juventus in the second leg. They're 1-0 up.
That's not going to happen, is it? that works. I mean, it's what Nasser Al-Khelaifi, the chairman of PSG, has said. He said we might have to think about playing these games abroad in a place which hasn't been hit by the virus as badly as we have been in Western Europe, or which is going over the, which is, you know, has gone over the worst of the pandemic, and where you can organize these things with behind closed doors, but minimum risk for the health of players, officials, and broadcasters, which is why I was throwing in the air the idea, well, why not China? Because the Chinese Super League is going to resume in not too long.
Is that a stupid idea?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's just an obscene idea. It's not stupid, it's obscene.
There's one reason why it's a very bad idea, because obviously if you say, well, so China has come through the coronavirus. Now, I know this is obviously perhaps exaggerating the situation, but China's come through the coronavirus. So what are we going to do? We're going to take a country that hasn't come through in it and fly a load of its people over there and give it back to them. Here, have it again. Let's start all over again.
So in France, Philippe, when play resumes next season, these players will have had, by that time, a five-month break, which is unprecedented for footballers to have that much time off. So it does beg the question about, you know, what kind of state they will be in when they eventually start playing again, if it is 5 months.
I've been talking to a physio of a leading club about this, and he told me, at the moment, they were completely in the dark. They had no idea. They had no reference point, because all you can do for the time being is individual conditioning. And you know how to keep somebody healthy and fit. That's not a problem. But to go to the stage of match fitness, it's as if you were dealing with a staff of 25 players, all of whom were coming back from a long-term injury and had a long layoff. And he basically said, we have no idea. We are basically, I wouldn't say making things up as we go along, but we are very worried about the impact it would have on the players, because we could have a spate of muscular injuries. We won't have any idea. You can test the players as you wish, but without a proper preseason, without, you know, warm-up games and so forth, it's really running a huge risk for players. And by the way, I think it's valid. I'm sure we hear the same thing in Spain. I'm sure we hear the same thing in England and elsewhere. I hear more and more people from within the game. I'm talking about players here. They're very quiet for the time being, but who are actually looking at this and thinking, hold on, guys, you're really playing with our health here. And we're not guinea pigs. We're human beings. You cannot possibly bring us back to a field of play and ask us to perform like professionals after a layoff of several months, because we genuinely have no idea how their bodies will react to that.
France have said no sport till September. The Spanish Prime Minister's announced professional athletes can return to training on the 4th of May, i.e. next Monday, Sid.
Yeah, and you can imagine the two things go together. So when that announcement came out in France, the reaction in Spain was very much, okay, this is where we follow. In the next 3 or 4 days, we'll get something similar said here. And then instead of that, we had Pedro Sanchez come out and announce this de-escalation program. Now, obviously, it's important to point out at this stage that this kind of four-phase program that he was talking about goes beyond professional footballers and beyond professional athletes. So there's a stage at which professional athletes can go back to individual training. But the third stage of this process also talks about amateur clubs being able to go back and doing individualised training. The reopening of club sports in that sense, bit by bit. Now, the other thing that's happened here, and I think we saw this quite clearly, was that there's clearly a huge amount of internal debate. And Philippe's talking about footballers, and footballers in Spain are saying different things. You know, some footballers are saying, yeah, we really want to go back, but we recognise that there's a risk, but obviously no more of a risk than doing a whole load of occupations that people are doing right now. And there are other players saying, absolutely not. You know, this just isn't right. And we saw, for example, a response from Racing Santander players basically saying, you know, we think it's then which is the next layer, that the if you like the ethical layer, where he said we think it's inappropriate that we should be able to go back in a process which involves daily testing at a time when frontline medical staff aren't being tested daily. So how can we morally and ethically allow this? And that's a whole other debate. Now, obviously, that's got a whole series of dimensions. For example, the fact that, and La Liga keeps saying this to us, look, any test that we do will only be done once they're authorised by the Ministry of Health. The Ministry of Health rules say that we can only do tests once the private companies that provide those tests have offered them to the government first. So we're not taking those tests off anyone else. There's a whole series of kind of ethical questions there. And no one really knows. But the other internal debate that's happened here very clearly is a debate between the CSD, which is effectively Spain's sports ministry, even though it's not called the sports ministry, effectively Spain's sports ministry, and the health ministry. And clearly there's been some debate there as well, because as La Liga keeps trying to tell everyone that will listen, you know, we're a big industry. You know, we're 1.8% of the GDP or whatever it is. You know, there's 180,000 people's jobs depend on this and all this kind of thing. And I think that's what we're going to see everywhere now. Forget sport. That tension between, okay, health and economy and how far those two things go together and where the balance lies. And truth is, at the moment, no one really knows.
I've noticed in England, like, there seems to be this sort of presumption that all footballers are happy to go back and play and want to go back and play. And I don't think that's necessarily the case. I heard Glenn Murray talking on the radio yesterday, Brighton striker, and he spoke very eloquently. And while he didn't say he didn't want to go back and play, he did have a lot of reservations for a lot of the reasons Sid mentions. Player safety, is it ethically correct when people are still dying? And you know, there also seems to be a bit of public expectation. Again, I'm only going on what I've seen on social media, which you have to caveat with. It's not a particularly accurate barometer of public opinion, but it's the only one I have at the moment. That some people seem to think players have a duty to go out and perform for them. It's like, you know, dance, monkey boy, dance. And I'm not so sure that a lot of players are particularly enthused about the prospect of having to go back and play.
In a way, I'm sort of surprised at the mood here. I thought there'd be a clamour for it more than there is in the UK. I wonder what it's like in Spain.
Yeah, I mean, again, as Barry's saying, it's difficult to say there is one particular attitude, because there isn't. There's a division of attitudes. We've seen, for example, and I don't know whether this counts as a surprise or not, that fans groups, and it's worth pointing out here that Spanish fans groups don't have the power that English fans group have. They get largely ignored. They're not at the table when there's negotiations, when there's discussions about this kind of thing. But FASFE, which is a group of a kind of a supporters group in Spain, and a whole series of supporters clubs and so on at various clubs have come out this week and said, we don't want to go back without fans, because football without fans is nothing. And we think, and that goes hand in hand with another argument, which is also to say, and we also think it's immoral to go back while this health thing is going on. So you've got fans who in theory might be those most clamouring for this to happen, are saying, actually, no, we don't want to go back in these conditions. We don't want to go back behind closed doors. We don't think it's right. Now, that's some fans groups. Obviously, there are loads of fans as well who do want football back for exactly the reasons that Barry's saying. And this is one of the things, one of the, if you like, the what would you call it, the kind of the discourse of the league. And actually, I think taken on board by the CSD, the sports ministry, is that idea that football can play a part in terms of expressing a kind of a togetherness, giving us something else to talk about. Yeah, I suppose the classic bread and circuses. You know, this is the circus in bread and circus. We can get people back. We can take people's minds off it. We can give them something else to think about. But I think people are very, I think people are very divided on this. And I think they're divided within themselves as well. I think there are a lot of people who don't know how they feel about this. And I think there's a lot of people as well who wonder if, hang on, when football comes back, will we even feel the same about it? Will it feel empty? Will it give us all the things that we always felt it did until now? Will it have changed? Will our relationship with it have changed?
Add to that the fact that in Germany, where, you know, the Länder have pronounced themselves in favor of, or I've said, you know, we would authorize games to resume, but there's now, it seems like a second wave, or there's a new peak, and so the federal government is hesitating. And one very interesting thing has been the attitude of the ultras. That's to rebound on what Sid was saying, and ultras, which have got a huge power in Germany, well, believe it or not, they're against it. They are against the resumption of games, a huge majority of them. So, and which means, again, that we shouldn't expect or think the fans want things to happen. The fan wants the games to resume. Actually, it's much more complicated than that. And in some cases, there is actually a very strong movement against what is felt to be a hurried, a rushed, and a completely immoral resumption of games, simply in the name of Mammon.
I want to talk about Michael Robinson, who passed away this week. Obviously won the league and won the European Cup with Liverpool back in 1984. It is rare that the front pages of Sport, AS, Marca and Mundo Deportivo are entirely focused on the same thing, but Spain lost a legend this week, and you wrote beautifully about it earlier this week in The Guardian.
Yeah, I mean, it's genuinely difficult, I think, to fully express to people outside of Spain how big Michael Robinson was, how significant he was, the impact that he had. Now, obviously, as you said, a European Cup winner as a player and a very good player, even though he always kind of talked about himself as a lucky man, as a man who been given the chance to experience far more than his talent should have allowed him to, which I think was you know, it says something about his character and his personality more than any lack of talent. But it was here off the pitch, really, that the impact happened. He changed the way that sports TV was done. He changed the way that people looked at football. He was universally popular. He was, you know, he was, in terms of his, if you like, his kind of a presence, I don't think it's a huge step to say that over the last 20 years, he may well have been the most significant TV personality in the entire country. I genuinely don't think that's a huge step. And, you know, I mentioned it in the piece I wrote about him. But you know, that old cliche about how to, you know, you've made it when your puppet is on Spitting Image. Well, the Spanish version of Spitting Image is presented by Michael Robinson's puppet. And I think in a way that kind of tells you, you know, that he really did totally change the way that sports media and sports television was done here.
How?
Well, look, what happened, I mean, it's quite a long process, but in a way it's very simple. What he did was he became the presenter of a show called El Día Después, the day after. And El Día Después was kind of a roundup show, but it was a roundup show where the cameras were turned not just on the pitch, but away from the pitch to the fans. And it was about the people. And Michael didn't just presenter Lillis West. He became the director, the producer of it. It was very much a show in his kind of his vision of what football is. And it was about people, fundamentally. It was that simple. It was a show that refused to sneer. It was a show that didn't have cynicism. It was a show that kind of celebrated football, but celebrated everyone who goes to football, everyone who's involved in football, not just the players. And in a way, it took you closer to the game itself by not looking at the game. And so I suppose you could kind of describe it as a mix between Match of the Day and Fantasy Football League and Football Focus, because there were reports and there were kind of hidden camera stuff and you know, some of the stuff that, for example, you know, that third eye thing that Soccer Saturday used to do. I don't know if it still does it, but that third eye that Soccer Saturday used to do was something that LDS West first did, Lo que el ojo no ve, what the eye doesn't see. And it would catch things happening in the stadiums that you hadn't noticed. And it was just kind of a celebration of the game. And I think Michael himself said it best. You know, he said always used to say, "Oh, this West is a football show that's offside free." You know, it's a show that's for the 30 million Spaniards, not for the five people who think they own the game. It's a show that's not going to get dragged into pointless debates about whether this goal that won the game was a split, you know, a millimetre offside. But let's celebrate the game itself. And that lovely phrase that he used, he said, you know, an offside is a wrinkle on Paul Newman's face. It doesn't make him any less beautiful. You know, it's still there. And it was about warmth, and it was about people, and it was about like, this, you know, we can all be in this, and it doesn't matter which team you support, and you don't need to be kind of focused on the if you like, the tension of teams to enjoy the game for itself and for everything that goes on around it. And that show ran for 15 years, and I honestly can't properly express how big it was, in that this was on Canal Plus, and Canal Plus used to be scrambled. So you get the screen and Canal Plus was scrambled. The screen was fuzzy, but they had three or four free to air shows a week. And one of them was El Día Después. And it was very much, and I know we've lost this culture now in TV, but it was one of those shows that kind of everybody watched. And on a Monday night, everyone was sitting in front of the telly watching El Día Después. And Michael was the focal point of that, as I say, in a creative sense, as well as being a presenter. And for 15 years, this was the show. It got discontinued, something which, while Michael never said so publicly, he never forgave them for. And it got discontinued. And what was put in its place was this horrible kind of attempt to be show business that just didn't work. Why? Because the humour, unlike the humour in El Día Después, was forced. It wasn't natural. It wasn't charming. It wasn't gentle. It wasn't what it had been. And so, but rather than give up, Michael then went in a different direction and began a documentary series called Informe Robinson. And again, while it was totally different because it was serious, because it was very worthy in the way it communicated, it was still fundamentally the same thing, in that it was still fundamentally, let's tell stories about people. You know, the game in a way is the vehicle for everything else. And that was particularly significant because he started doing that at a time when the football media was very definitely going back towards, right, let's have furious debates. Let's make this about teams. Let's make sure every journalist has a team that he defends no matter what they do, and another team that he attacks no matter what they do. And I think what Michael projected was the idea that you could be nice and you could enjoy football and you could celebrate it and you could talk about people and you didn't need to be at each other's throats all the time. And I think that's one of the reasons why people liked him. And people liked him, I think, fundamentally because he liked people.
Philippe, you would like to pay tribute to two figures from French football who also passed away this week.
Yes, it's been, you know, obviously a few difficult weeks. Michel Hidalgo, Pep Diouf, and now we've heard of the death of one of Rennes' greatest players, probably his greatest players ever, Louis Cardier, who died recently, but more tragically, the death of Robert Herbin, one of the most famous hairdos in football, I would imagine. I mean, people remember, you know, the manager of Saint-Étienne, the great Saint-Étienne side of the 1970s, which he coached completely impassive on the touchline, which is why he was called the Sphinx. That was his nickname. A beautiful nickname, by the way, for a footballer. And he was a great player himself. He won the championship, I think, five times with Saint-Étienne. He also won the league four times with the same club. He was also somebody who was a one-off. And there's a little story I would like to tell you told by my friend Vincent Duluc. Because Robert Herbin also went to Lyon, which is a bit like having been a manager of Arsenal, you go to Tottenham. And he spent a few seasons there. And Vincent asked him, what was your best moment at Lyon? And he'd been fiddling, Robert had been fiddling with a little transistor radio, trying to get the equivalent of Radio 3 to get some classical music. So he thought, and his answer was, oh, my best moment in Lyon, that would have been that Berlioz concert at the Maurice Ravel Auditorium. And that was the kind of man he was. Very, very dry at times, not acerbic, but very generous as well, very loyal. And very much loved. And to be honest with him, it's a big part of this French football of the 1970s, which, you know, goes away from us, and very, very fondly remembered memories of this great Saint-Étienne side, of which he's completely inseparable. So this was Robert Herbin. And I should add as well that he is a victim. He was a victim of that awful virus, but for a different reason. He had a heart problem, and he was confined, and the neighbor who used to come and see him to check out he was okay couldn't do it for a few days. By the time they realized that he was in a really bad way, it was too late. So awful, awful end to the life of a magnificent man.
God, heartbreaking. Late last night as well, news broke of Trevor Cherry's death at the age of 72. He had 27 caps for England, captaining the side once. He played for a decade for Leeds United, joining at the tail end of the Don Revy era and winning the First Division in 1974. He joined his first club, Huddersfield, as a 15-year-old, initially joining as part of the ground staff before earning himself a contract. He managed for 5 years at Bradford, player manager for the first three of those. So we send our best wishes to his family and friends, of course. That is the end of part two. We'll say goodbye to Sid Lowe. Goodbye, Sid.
Cheerio.
Philippe, you're going to stay with us for part three.
Will do.
We'll be back in a minute. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Regarding the Premier League, not a lot of solid news from the league or the clubs this week. They're preparing for a meeting this Friday with preparation for football's return, taking up Parliament time as well. In terms of Project Restart, the aim seems to be starting football again on the weekend of the 13th of June. A few logistical hurdles, one being the estimated 2 million tests required. And the police have warned that marquee fixtures may need to be held at neutral grounds to minimise the risk of fans turning up and congregating outside stadiums. I mean, you could imagine they'd still turn up outside stadiums anyway. They go to away games, don't they? There's a lot of good reporting about this in the paper, which we recommend you check out in print or online. A couple of other slightly interesting things coming out of the Premier League. Manchester United have received permission to install 1,500 barrier seats standing with rails as a trial measure. They'll install the new section in the northeast quadrant of Old Trafford for the 2020-21 season. If it works, the club will look to install barrier seats in other areas of the stadium. I don't know if either of you heard Maurizio Pochettino on BT Sport yesterday. Jack asking the question, do you think Poch will ever come back to Spurs? Do you think he meant what he said last night? Or it's just the standard PR stuff? He said, this is Pochettino, it was an amazing journey that finished the way no one wanted it finished. But deep in my heart, I'm sure our paths will cross again. From the day I left the club, my dream is to be back one day to try to finish the work we didn't finish. We were so close to winning the Premier League and Champions League. Of course, I'm looking forward to moving on and I'm so motivated for the next project. But deep inside, I want to go back because the fans are so special. Maybe in 5 years, maybe in 10. But before I die, I want to manage Tottenham. I want to feel what it means to win one title with Tottenham because the fans are amazing. All the love we received was amazing, and that is a good opportunity to pay back all the love they showed us from day one. Philippe, you are laughing.
I'm laughing. I'm crying. I think it's time to... You should play Dame Varaline. We'll meet again. Maybe it's cabin fever. I don't know. Possibly. I'm sure that the fans, Tottenham, would be absolutely delighted, judging by the response on social network to that little video. I don't know why not. He's allowed to be a bit emotional. He's still paid by Tottenham, by the way. So there you go.
Yeah, I don't know if Maurizio had had a few pints or not, but what he said would bring a tear to a glass.
I still love her.
Yeah. I would say to Poch, don't go back, mate. Never go back. But... I'm sure Spurs fans would be delighted to have him. I'd love to have him back in the Premier League. I'm a big fan of his. He's a lovely bloke.
Yeah, the rumours that Newcastle's prospective owners, if they ever take over, want to pay him $19 million a year to go to St James's Park. So we shall see, I guess. In Scotland, still rumbling on. Members of the SPFL board have written to all 42 member clubs, warning them not to pursue an investigation into the vote to end the season. They cited the strain an investigation would put on their financial and resource limitations, which probably doesn't mean much to clubs who are spending this lockdown feeling wronged. Susie Rack has reported in the paper this week the Women's National League team AFC Fylde have become the first women's team to disband as a result of the coronavirus pandemic. She, of course, was saying that there is a real danger, as there are with lower league men's clubs, but with affiliated women's clubs, that this will not be the last of those. And Ed Aaron's reporting that Colchester United have become the first club in the EFL to release players due to the financial impact of the coronavirus. Four of them, with captain Luke Prosser and three other first team regulars as well. It's been quite a week for Alan Pardew. He joined ADO Den Haag with the aim of steering them away from relegation. In his eight games in charge, they won once, got three draws and lost four. They were 3 points from safety when he arrived and 7 points from safety when play stopped. The Dutch authorities ended the Eredivisie early with no relegation. Pardew has done his job and kept them up. It was then reported that the club were due to pay him £100,000 as a bonus, but he has released a statement on the club website to say he wouldn't take it. 2 days later, his contract was terminated by mutual consent. A Richard Jolly stat for all of us. Alan Pardew's last three league wins have come in three different years, 2016, 2018 and 2020. I mean, it's not fair, with three different clubs, Palace, West Brom and Den Haag. So judging by that, his next win with another club should be in 2022. We had the development this week of the fiancé of Jamal Khashoggi personally warning the Premier League that allowing the Saudi takeover of Newcastle United to go through would, quote, greatly stain the reputation of the Premier League and the UK. The owners and directors test has apparently been going for 3 weeks already, with no hitches expected in the next week or so it'll take to complete. Philippe, you had something to say on this?
I had several things to say on this. First of all, I think that the way that the UK media have been reporting on that has been unsatisfactory, in as much I think what we've read so far has been PR for one particular side of these negotiations. That's one thing. The second thing is that, as you know, the Qataris are obviously, Qataris who have an eye on Leeds United, are very angry with the idea that the Saudis could get a club in the Premier League, and have made an official representation to the 20 clubs of the Premier League, as well as to the Premier League itself. And now I was just looking in the in my archives, and I found two statements by the Premier League, one of them dated 2018, one of them dated 2019, in which the Premier League had a right go at Saudi Arabia for allowing the parroting of Be In Sport by Be Out Q, which is based in Saudi Arabia. And you know that's the reason why why the Qataris are complaining very, very vocally. And I have to say, I'm waiting with some interest for a response from the Premier League, because the Premier League actually nominally, more or less, accused Saudi Arabia of enabling the bootlegging of images it sold to one of its clients, and now is about to say, well, that's okay, you can own a club or 80% of a club. So it's going to be interesting to see how they deal with that particular complaint. That's what I would say.
While no fan of piracy, am I allowed to find it amusing that they decided to call the people pirating Be In, Be Out?
Yes, you're allowed.
Good. It just couldn't be more brazen, could it? You know, it's like a burger joint calling itself McDonald's or something, isn't it? Mm-hmm.
And by the way, Max, before people say you have no right to say Saudi Arabia was responsible for the piracy, first of all, I didn't say that. I said they turned a blind eye to it. And the second thing, there have been independent studies on this particular case, which showed that at least, yes, there was a kind of benevolent attitude from the Saudi regime to the bootleggers. And actually, so much so that, as I said, the Premier League issued two statements in which this was strongly suggested. So, yes, yet again, it's an interesting exercise, shall we say.
Here's a question for you, Barry. Ben says, what is the perfect width of stripes on a football shirt?
Oh, crikey. I have no idea. I mean, I'm not one of these shirt or kit nerds. I see people I know, respect and admire obsessing over football shirts. Ellis James in particular is absolutely obsessed with football shirts. It's never been something that really got my juices flowing, I have to say. I'm not that fussed about kit. I feel a little bad that not having a good answer to this question, because I haven't really spoken for about 20 minutes. And then you come to me with a question after the Philippe show and I've no answer for you.
During matches, some games you're going to be quiet for 88 minutes. You might bring out some gold, but you've finally got the ball at your feet and you're so knackered from all the running you're doing without getting the ball, Barry. Maybe you could do better with this one. Johnny says, Guardian Football Weekly below the line questions. Quote, Peter from Shropshire asks the pod, out of Harvey Barnes, Ashley Barnes and John Barnes, who would build the best barn?
I would say Cliff Barnes from Dallas, JR's nemesis.
Why? Was he good in construction?
No, I have no idea. Again, I have failed you. I really should have just this. Left at the end of part two, to be honest.
Dell says, when the inevitable television adaptation of Detective Wilson lands, will Philippe Auclair record the theme tune? And if so, will it be more Maigret or Van der Valk in tone?
I thought about that. I think it would be an extremely dark theme. The tune to Maigret is a little bit too jolly. It's a waltz. I don't know if you know, it's actually a very, very memorable tune, to the French Maigret. I would probably go noir for, absolutely jazz and noir for Inspector Wilson. Little known fact, Mr. Wilson, Detective D.I. Wilson, doesn't listen to music a lot, if at all, but the music he listens to is jazz.
Wow.
Particularly hard bop.
Hard bop.
Hard bop. Not many people know that, but I know it because I've seen him put the needle on a John Coltrane album.
What's the difference between hard bop and soft bop?
No, hard bop, you've got... We're not going to go there today. There is no such thing as soft bop. There is bop and then there's hard bop. But we'll come to there later on.
isn't there also bebop?
There is bebop, absolutely.
Producer Jonathan's head in his hands. Finally, Barry. Gus says, when Barry reads the lyrics, as soon as it ends, it says, for more great podcasts from The Guardian, go to theguardian.com. There can't possibly be anything greater than Barry Reed's lyrics, right? You are right, but they will come. Now, Barry, I've got some choices for you. Perhaps Philippe can choose one of these. Charlie would like to read Barry to read Vienna by Ultravox. Finnegan would like him to read Around the World by Daft Punk. Eric says, can Barry read Call Me Maybe by Carly Rae Jepsen? And Adam says, another call from me for Barry to recite the lyrics to Never Ever by All Saints.
I personally would be very, very happy to hear Vienna myself.
Well, there we are. As chosen by Philippe Auclair, Barry Glendenning reads Vienna by Ultravox. Philippe, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Barry, thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
For more great podcasts, go to theguardian.com.
We walked in the cold air, freezing breath on a window pane, lying and waiting, a man in the dark in a picture frame. So mystic and soulful, a voice reaching out in a piercing cry. It stays with you until the feeling has gone, only you and I. It means nothing to me. This means nothing to me. Oh, Vienna. The music is weaving. Haunting notes, pizzicato strings, the rhythm is calling. Alone in the night as the daylight brings a cool empty silence. The warmth of your hand and a cold grey sky, it fades to the distance. The image is gone, only you and I, it means nothing to me. This means nothing to me. Oh, Vienna. This means nothing to me. This means nothing to me. Oh, Vienna.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.